Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. A rough start to the month. The Dow already down more than 4.5% in April. The volatility index soaring to its highest level since October. Is this just the beginning of the end of the rally? We'll debate that. And a shining trade. Gold hitting another record today as investors flock to the safety of that trade. How much higher can prices go? And later, chips get checked on a warning from China. Starbucks shares go decaffeinated. And Netflix on deck to report a look at the charts and an options trade on the streamer ahead of its earnings. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Bono and Ison, Carter Worth, and Steve Grasso. And we start off with today's big Friday fade. Stocks closing out the week with a sharp sell-off, the Dow dropping nearly 500 points, the S&P and Nasdaq both falling around 1.5%, this adding to the stormy start to April, the major indices all on pace to break five-month winning streaks. Volatility surging, passing the 19 handle today. It was at 13 at the start of the month. Well, rates spiked after this week's hot inflation data, the 10-year yield soaring back above 4.5% before pulling back a little bit today. The latest cloud over stocks, banks striking a cautious tone as results start to come in. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon warning of the triple threat from inflation, war, and Fed policy. And BlackRock's Larry Fink saying the central bank may miss its inflation target. The KBE on track for its worst month since the collapse of SVB last March. All of this as Q1 earnings season gets started and investors brace for a potential attack on Israel by Iran. So can the market rally get back on track, or is this just the start of a bigger sell-off to come? Tim, what do you say?
I think it really is the geopolitical climate that is part of where we close the week. And we've said this, and if you know those boxes you check when you're filling out the survey, what keeps you up most at night, it's not necessarily 21 times forward on the S&P. It's geopolitics. And Iran, I'll leave aside, you know, really the analysis politically and obviously socially of Iran potentially invading Israel. But what that means for a flight to quality. Look at the dollar move. The dollar's rallied 2.5% in the last 3 days. If you take the intraday low to intraday high, the price in oil and oil prices, Iran in Israel means oil higher for longer. You know, we talk about interest rates higher for longer. So it was a day. It was as bad of a day as markets have seen since January. You brought up the VIX. It's the fact that the VIX is now up more year to date than semiconductors. And I'm sure Carter's got a view on where semis, which have been such leadership. I mean, you know, you look at a day like today and you look at where they are now, they're down about 5% over the last month relative to the S&P, which they've led for the last 2.5 years. So a very big market day, and I think geopolitics led the charge.
I mean, the VIX has been sleepy for so long, Bono, and to see it surge like this on a Friday seems even more unusual.
Yeah, that move from 13 to 18 has been pretty aggressive there. And it's been, to me, a little over long overdue. We've waited to see, like, how long this malaise is going to work, how long we can continue to grind high on, yes, some improvement in earnings, but real legitimate price-to-earnings expansion. And I think it's just a matter of time. Frankly, to answer your question, do I think this is the beginning of a trend or the start of a counter trend? Listen, I think, at least as things stand right now, it's a relatively healthy situation for us to see some increase in protection buying, some increase in volatility, being that the narrative around rates being stable has started to shift, and you start to see that push out from June to September. So seeing nothing in light of the geopolitical risks that Tim mentioned and the other things that I'm mentioning, I think this makes sense and probably sets up for more of a healthy market.
I mean, look, we've come a long way, right? Everybody yep. knows this, and everyone has been waiting, watching. At what point does the thing pause? And we know from that October low to present, we're talking about a six-month move. So there are only three time frames. There's minor, intermediate, and major. And this is an intermediate move that's mature, 6 months in the making, S&P up 28%. But it's not just the S&P, and it's not AI. Caterpillar's up 60. American Express is up 60. So old-world companies that have no AI in them have appreciated to such an extent and to such levels that you're due for what would be something corrective. It's why it's part of the word. Etymology says it's incorrect. If you keep going like this, we're in the process of correcting.
I always feel smarter when you're on the desk, Carter.
Why do you feel smart? I feel more dumb whenever he's on the desk.
Etymology.
That's probably the first time it's ever been used on our show.
Yeah. I always order that.
This is
in a restaurant.
Actually, a better setup ahead of earnings, right? To have some sort of sell-off as opposed to having a rally into earnings season.
Yeah, and I think that's what happened with J.P. Morgan, where the setup for J.P. Morgan was so pristine, where they were the head of all financials, and they ran into earnings where they were just jumping hurdles left and right. So I think you're right. You want to have a pullback. This was a confluence of events. It's on a Friday. Mm-hmm. People de-risk on a Friday. You have Iran coming up. We have Ukraine, Russia. Everyone has forgotten about that. We have China supporting Russia in Ukraine. That has become, we become numb to that. This is definitely a more sensitive issue. If this escalates to a point where it involves the entire region, then it's something to really concentrate on. But when we're just talking, we're taking that out of it. Let's see where we are on Monday. Let's see. Hopefully nothing escalates this weekend and we can get back to just looking at the market in a prism or through that prism. But if it does escalate, oil, semiconductors, because now people start talking about everything. People start talking about China, Taiwan on the back of this as well, because there's going to be an awful lot of things going on. But I think you're right. If the market can pull back, the 50-day moving average in the S&P is 5111. We got there, bounced a little bit. And at this point, that's the level where Carter's talking about. Do you check it? Do you break that level? And then people will start talking about, okay, where are the next levels below 5,000? If we break 5,000 to the downside, that catches everyone's attention. We're in a political year. I still think the market's okay.
I mean, let's talk about J.P. Morgan, since that's you talk about somebody who does movie rentals or sneakers. J.P. Morgan's a different animal, right? And it dropped hard today.
Yep.
Because why? It's maybe about the earnings, but maybe it was because it was up 50% when the S&P's up 20% from the same low to the present. Or, Tim, you speak about valuation. What's probably price to tangible book? It's probably near the top
of the range. Yeah, it's probably around 1.5. And the other thing we heard about J.P. Morgan is that their net interest income, which I thought they were going to tell us is actually still a pretty robust environment. Higher rates is good for them. And it is. But they have higher funding costs. And this is what we heard from other banks. So higher rates also extract a price. And I think getting back to rates, this was also, let's talk about the other, big elephant in the room this week. It was rates. It was the third consecutive dud on a CPI number, which puts the Fed obviously on hold. Every Fed governor and their brother was out there after Jerome Powell, kind of backtracking in terms of what they have to do this year or maybe not, certainly putting it on pause. So we got to a place where now September, by the end of this week, this is not where we started. We are firmly in September consensus. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. But if you get into a place where if at some point in the next poor inflation print, we get to a sense where the Fed's next pivot is maybe a rate hike or two. And I realize that's an absurd thing to say, but you can be sure equities haven't priced that in. Equities, we question whether they priced in zero cuts.
I don't think they have. But do you think they have?
Have they priced in
zero?
I don't think they've gotten to zero yet.
No. And I think that will be the next step.
No doubt.
That, right? I mean, we're not that far away from pricing in zero. When a lot of banks on the street are going to just one in December, that can easily be pushed out to 2025.
Yeah, I don't think you're at 21 times forward earnings, assuming that there weren't going to be any rate cuts. I don't think that's sustainable if this higher for longer narrative is actually sees the follow through, that it's looking more and more likely that actually will be the case. And the last thing I'll say is, I really think the last thing that the consumer or the Federal Reserve really wants to see is sustained commodity prices. Now, we don't, that's stripped out in terms of the CPIX, and we're already talking about some of the inflationary pressures around there, at least from a consumer standpoint and their ability to continue to prop this economy up. If we really start to see that trickle-down effect into gas prices at the pump, particularly when we're not seeing the relief in housing, I really don't think that bodes well.
So to Tim's point, this is the first time since 2021 that J.P. Morgan has seen net interest income shrink or come in a little bit. So that caught the market off guard. But let's remember, yesterday the market was up. It was dealing with rates. Today the market's down. This to me is, if you have to give a percentage, because that's what we're all paid to do, 80% of this was geopolitical. So it was just risk-taking off the table. Monday, Tuesday, let's see how it shakes out. But I don't think that this is going to be a year without any rate cuts. I do believe we're still going to get 3 rate cuts this year.
So if there's no attack, Monday are we up? I mean, is that's your thesis?
If there's an ongoing dialogue, we don't know what that dialogue, if we're in the same place we are right now. But yes, if there's no attack and the dialogue gets better and the rhetoric is better and softer, then the market rips higher.
I think the single biggest data point is the JP Morgan drop in gap, because that's not geopolitics. That is that this is a rich market and you've got to be priced for perfection and then still beat and raise and guide. And if you don't, you're going to get, we've seen it. Philip Van Heusen, Lululemon.
Right.
We've seen drop and gap after drop and gap.
I'm more worried about mega cap tech. Mega cap tech is where this market has led. That's got the biggest concentration. The S&P will go where mega cap tech goes as long as earnings are good there.
Well, in this environment, though, ahead of earnings season, you know, in light of these gaps because of run-ups into earnings, in light of the geopolitical, is mega cap tech still defensive?
I think it is. And again, you know, we heard some interesting comments from Andy Jassy on the network yesterday that indicate that there's also more earnings power possibly in these names from investments that they've made. But I think we've seen time and time again, mega cap tech being defensive. Carter's absolutely right. That move in JP Morgan was extraordinary. It is interesting, though, on a day the inferior bank in Citi drops, you know, 1.5%, and Citi, which rallied 63% off that October pivot as well. So cheaper quality and maybe less crowded for sure.
Yes.
And that partially explains it.
Yeah, particularly if you're going to juxtapose the moves between JP Morgan and Citigroup, I don't think either net interest guidance was particularly rosy. I think JP Morgan, as you mentioned, I think you said 1.5. I think it trades at 1.6 times book. I think Citi's trading at about 0.6 times book. So just from a valuation standpoint, I tend to agree with Carter here in terms of the fact that we are in a situation where this next earnings cycle and the subsequent one are going to be paramount, because we're no longer here saying that funding conditions, financing conditions are going to ease. This is really going to be about, is the E portion of price to earnings sustainable and leading us to growth going forward? If not, I do not think we sit here at 21 times forward earnings in the foreseeable future.
Let's talk now more about the rising tensions in the Middle East. The Wall Street Journal reporting that the U.S. is moving warships to the shores off Israel amid a warning that an Iranian attack is imminent. President Biden a short time ago warning Iran against any move, saying, quote, don't. This is Brent oil is back above $90 a barrel and WTI topping $87 today. So how will this all shake out? Let's ask former NATO Supreme Allied Commander General Wesley Clark. General, great to have you with us. Thank you. What do you think is going to happen? Because it seems that Iran doesn't want this to get out of hand. Nobody wants this to get out of hand, and yet these things tend to.
Well, obviously, we've picked up indications that Iran is making preparations to do something. Now, that's at the military level. There's a bluster at the political level. But does Iran really want a confrontation directly with Israel? Iran's moving toward atomic or nuclear weapons capacity. Some people say they've already got a couple. Others say maybe another 3 or 4 months. If Iran strikes Israel, Israel is going to go right back at that nuclear capacity, everything they've identified, and the Ayatollah is going to lose everything that they've worked for. Besides, Iran's kind of a basket case internally. They're taking away people's social security. There's high inflation. Some of the soldiers, not the Revolutionary Guards, but ordinary soldiers, are refusing to work because they're not getting paid. So the mullahs are in no position to start a big war. On the other hand, Israel would probably welcome a chance to go in and take out the Iranian nuclear facilities, because they know that once that comes in, it's an entirely different game in the Middle East. The United States doesn't want the escalation. The United States would like Israel to trust it. But Israel's not going to trust the United States if Iran strikes. Can't. Because look at what's happening in Gaza right now with the pressure between the United States and Israel. But, you know, bottom line on this is, if Iran does something, my instinct is that it's going to be something relatively minor, something indirect, something the mullahs can cheer about, but not something that can be directly attributed to Iran. Maybe a strike on an embassy somewhere by some unknown terrorist group, something like that. if they really strike Israel, you will have escalation, and Iran will definitely be the loser.
General Clark, it's Tim Seymour. It's an honor to have you here. Just refresh for us then, again, U.S. strategy here, especially as it relates to our relationship with Israel. It's getting more complicated. Obviously, Iran brings a different element. As you said, the U.S. doesn't want to see this. Nobody wants to see this. Can you refresh for us your perspective on the strategy on Israel in the Middle East?
So for the United States, the idea is to continue to reassure Israel, we've got your back. You don't have to do anything. Let's get this situation in Gaza settled. Don't go into South Lebanon. Don't make the problem any bigger. That's the American perspective. And for the Israeli perspective, well, they see it as a sort of existential crisis. They cannot let Hamas come out of this as a winner. They've still got a problem in South Lebanon with the Iranians, and the clock is ticking on an Iranian nuclear capacity, which changes everything. So Israel sees it very differently than the United States does at this point. And yet Israel knows it must have U.S. support. It must have the friendship of Washington.
Yeah, and President Biden said just this afternoon that the U.S. is devoted to Israel's defense. General, I'm wondering, you know, if Iran really does attack in a small way, as you hope or anticipate, does that mean that Israel does not go after Iranian nuclear assets?
Probably won't go after the Iranian nuclear assets unless there's a direct strike on Israel or direct attributable to Iran strike on an embassy in the region. In other words, if Iran uses a missile and gets through or something, but you know, the Houthis are already firing missiles and drones at Israel, and Israel's taking them all out. So if you're the Iranians, the military or the Revolutionary Guards may be thirsting to go after Israel. But if you've got any common sense about it, you say, not so smart, not so smart. Let's don't do this. You know, Iran has to feel like they're kind of winning right now. They've got the United States and Israel at odds. Hamas has survived. You've got the whole world down on the Israelis for what's going on in Gaza. This was part of the plan. This was the plan from the beginning for Hamas to draw the Israelis in and then accuse them of creating a humanitarian catastrophe. That's what the world sort of sees right now. And so if you're the Iranians, why shake the tree? Let it play out. So that's me trying to think like the mullahs might think. But if I were the mullahs, I'd be very worried about what's happening inside Iran with the people, the economy. I'd look at the United States. I'd say, look, we're winning. Why do this? Find a way to do something so we can maintain face. But don't get into a big escalation with Israel right now. Wait till we get our nuclear capacity.
Do you think by Monday we'll have much more clarity about the situation between Iran and Israel?
Well, we will if Iran does something minor, but I think this could drag for a few days. There's no pressure on the Iranians necessarily that I see to go and finish this for the news cycle or the weekend or whatever. There's no pressure at all. So if they think they've got pressure between the United States and Israel, they've got friction between the United States and Israel, they've got greater pressure for the United States to force Israel to do a ceasefire in Gaza, they'll let it play out. One thing we've seen about the mullahs all this time is that they've got patience, they're smart, they're conniving, they're sly, they work indirectly. So I don't know that we'll have clarity by Monday.
All right. General Clark, thank you so much for joining us. We do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
General Wesley Clark. So if this is drawn out, do we see a continued flight to the the safety trades that we saw in today's session? Do we see a bid for bonds? Do we see a bid for the dollar? Do we see a bid for gold? Do we see that continue?
I think you see all of that continue. I think you see oil trade up. And it's not going to matter. The U.S. is self-sufficient in oil, but it's just the perception is reality. So you see all of the risk off or risk on trades still happen and be precipitously happening throughout the entire market this whole week. But hopefully we get something more than just rhetoric for the next 2 days. We get something that has some closure involved in it, or else you're just going to see gold run, oil run, and the S&P slide.
Trends in the dollar and rates and in oil are we've had them all year. I mean, it's been a trend to higher. So this news is part of a bigger mosaic of geopolitics. And no, it doesn't end no matter what happens.
Coming up, semis close out the week deep in the red. Shares of AMD and Intel getting hit on fresh reports that China is looking to phase out chips from foreign companies. A fallout across tech after the break. Plus, a retail rout, the XRT retail ETF closing in on a 10% drop this month. And we're not even halfway through April. Is this a sign the consumer is finally cracking? We will debate that.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. U.S. chip makers Intel and AMD down today on reports that China is cracking down on the use of foreign chips. The Wall Street Journal reporting that China is ordering its major telecom carriers to stop using non-Chinese core processors by 2027. China is Intel's biggest market, accounting for 27% of its revenue last year. AMD also owes 15% of its 2023 sales to the Chinese market. What do the charts look like, Carter?
Well, we know that semis were a great leader, of course, and now they've been under pressure before the market got under pressure. It's also worth noting, and this is the thing that's so confounding, semis only just in the past 8 weeks were able to get back to their relative highs in the dot-com peak. So it took 24 years to simply break even to the S&P, despite all of this tremendous outperformance. And they're way behind the queues. Anyway, I think you want to be not embracing the weakness. Well, you can buy a dip or you can stay away from it. I would stay away from it.
It always surprises me to hear these reports about China looking to take out American semis. You always sort of assume that maybe they didn't allow it in the first place. And yet here we are. They do exist in some of the infrastructure. They are going to order these carriers to take them out. And what does that mean? And at some point, do we start thinking, let's take the China market out? What are these stocks worth without a China market, or with a substantially smaller China market?
I think you definitely think along those lines, right? We talked about that with Apple previously. We've talked about that as it pertains to Nike. And I think you really starting, and we also mentioned in terms of Taiwan Semi, some of the geopolitical risks there. So I think it only makes sense that we start to factor this in and start stripping out some of that revenue, or at least discounting it by some increasing margin. Listen, I think in terms of the Intel story, I think the bullish case there is really about kind of like the reshoring of manufacturing, foundry type of business. And I think, you know, valuation as well, although you've started to see that creep up from low teens to now mid-20s. But I think the bull case there is really about them completely reinventing themselves and where they fit in terms of semiconductors. AMD, I do think, has gotten caught up a bit more in terms of the AI revolution and a lot of the more domestic issues that are going on. So I do worry there. I think that one trades around 45, 46 time forward. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see a little bit more air kind of come out of that balloon there, particularly as you start siphoning off what I believe is mid-teens in terms of revenue generation out of China.
That bullish part of the story for Intel, though, in terms of the foundries, I mean, they just said that they're going to have losses associated with the foundry.
Yeah, that
business.
Wasn't bullish.
So that wasn't bullish either. So at what point do you say, you know what, this is going to take too long, this turnaround?
I think they provided at least initial details on their product release and their, you know, their foundry, their resegmentation essentially in P&L, and they told you that it isn't going to be pretty anytime soon. And that was April 3rd. I think it was April 2nd, maybe after the close. Since then, the stock's down 25%. Laughed at myself, possibly. You know, I've traded Intel around. I've certainly been long on this move, and I think at this point you've taken out a lot of that bad news. But I'm sure Carter will point out that if we get more pullback in the market, maybe semis will lead that. I think they're all going to suffer, and they're still up 26, 27% year to date as a group. Higher rates will send them lower.
you know, if you look at this, Carter started off, Qualcomm, 59% of their revenue from China or thereabouts. Broadcom, 45%. Marvell, 48%. Texan, 48%. So you flashed up Intel in the beginning of the story. That seems like it's pretty light compared to all these other ones. And I think they got a pass because when you saw the story, they mentioned Intel, AMD. These are the ones you have to be concerned with more.
All right. There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Cracks in the consumer. Is the retail trade about to wreak havoc on investors? The chart careening toward precarious levels and where it's headed next, coming up. Plus, gold's gleaming gains. The precious metal hitting another all-time high today. What's fueling the record rally? And how long can the good times roll? We'll shine a light on that and much more next. You're watching Fast Money live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Retail getting hammered again today. The S&P Retail ETF dropping 2% today, crossing below its 100-day moving average during today's session. It is off 9% just this month. The biggest laggards today include Carvana, dropping nearly 7%, Foot Locker, slumping almost 6%, Dollar General, Kohl's, and Target also taking on the chin. And one of the ugliest charts in the sector may be Lululemon. That stock tumbling 34%. 34% so far this year. The athleisure maker off another 4% today at its lowest since last May. Tim, you flagged the XRT chart for us today.
Yeah, and certainly Lulu is a name I've been watching, you know, largely from the short side, and I think it can go lower. I think even if you look at the chart, maybe Carter's got a view. I think 300's within sights. But yeah, Jefferies has a fascinating note, and again, it's just a note that compares, but it says this looks a little to them like Under Armour, like brand is slipping, competition, a couple missteps, some strategic missteps, and this all happens at a peak multiple. And they're saying maybe you could be in mid-teens. Remember, this was one 35-ish. So, look, still, I think, an incredible brand, still a company I think you want to own at a lower price. But that's a fascinating argument. And, again, ubiquity is something you don't want to have in this space.
It's a free fall, right? So we're down 35%. At some point, and I think we're close, it's so bad it's good, where even if it goes lower on a 6 or 9 month basis, the path lower passes through a higher price. That's what bounces are all about. And I would tactically take that approach.
So play like at bounce. What level? Like at
I'd,
what
I'd do it here.
Oh, here.
And there's
okay.
So many ways that you could do it through options, for instance.
Oh,
we've never heard of that.
Never, never.
But Bonaway knows a thing or two about options.
I do. I mean, I'm kind of inclined to wait, although I do still believe that this is a premium name. I have a hard time drawing parallels to Under Armour. I think that has been misstep after misstep, and they, you know, were at the forefront, particularly able to take a bit of market share from Nike and some lesser competitors. But I think they just really got on the offsides in terms of that. I think Lululemon is still very much, the mere acquisition notwithstanding, is still very much associated with being a premium brand, and you're starting to see that is still very popular with the younger generation. You've started to see some of those trends not hold up with the Foot Lockers and the Under Armour.
I mean, I had a conversation with a portfolio manager today who is a large holder, and he said, well, you know, bell bottoms are coming back, and people don't want a tapered leg. And I said, you got to be kidding. What? Bell bottoms are coming back.
That's a client meeting.
Yeah, no. He was talking. He brought this up. Bell bottoms are coming back.
He didn't say what kind of client it was.
Yeah, bell bottoms are coming back, and therefore the tapered leg look of a Lululemon is going to be out. I'm like,
you don't think Lululemon can shift and
exactly? I was like, this is what it's come down to: bell bottoms versus tapered legs.
I'm kind of happy the bell bottoms coming back. I'm not for nothing.
None of us are shocked at what
I think things got too tapered.
I think it was more. I said it last night. PVH guide that I think spooked the entire market. Granted, you've seen the momentum to the downside with a lot of these. Tim talked about in the beginning. It's competition. You have a lot of private companies that are doing the same stuff. When Lulu came out with men's clothes, everyone thought, oh, they're going to double their revenue. Right?
No.
But they came out with Ren's Coast. So, and now.
A new target market for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And now people are replicating that in the private world. They're replicating that. And there's plenty of spots that you can go to and get the same thing.
All right, coming up, gold hitting another record high today as stocks close out a losing week. We'll debate whether the commodity can keep rising amid the broader market's pain. That is next. Plus, a who's who of earnings kick off next week. Netflix, United Airlines, Taiwan Semi, and more. We'll break down how the options market is positioning around the results right after this.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money Podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. A tough day for stocks to close out a big week of losses. The Dow losing 475 points. It had been down nearly 600 at its lows. The S&P falling nearly 1.5%, its worst day since January. And the Nasdaq closing out a three-week losing streak, nearly 2% lower. Apple, meantime, bucking the trend, managing to close in the green. It was up more than 4% this week. Meanwhile, Globe Life shares bouncing back somewhat from its 50% plus drop yesterday. That after a scathing short report from Fuzzy Panda Research that alleged multiple counts of insurance fraud. Globe Life has refuted those allegations. And Boeing shares falling for a 10th straight day, down every trading day in April. That's its longest losing streak since 2018. And finally, some moves in the metals. Copper ticking higher as it closes out a positive week. Silver dropping almost 0.5%. And gold reversing into the red after hitting yet another all-time high today. Well, the Sprott Physical Gold Trust is up more than 13% this year as investors lean into the commodity. As an inflation hedge, the fund offers a way to hold the physical metal. Demand for the bar is so strong that people are even flocking to Costco to buy them up. A recent Wells Fargo report estimating the warehouse store selling as much as $200 million worth of gold bars, of one-ounce gold bars, a month. For more on all things gold, let's bring in Sprott's John Ciampaglia. He is the firm's CEO. John, great to have you with us.
Great to be back.
I guess Costco shoppers are buying gold, but it's really central banks that are doing most of the buying here. And you see that trend continuing?
Yeah, we've seen a real meaningful shift, I would say, over the last 18 months or so, where central banks around the world are really starting to increase their percentage of gold as part of their foreign reserves. China is clearly leading the way there. They have a voracious appetite to add more gold. We think this is part of a de-dollarization trend that's going on. But it's not just China. We've seen banks, central banks in Turkey, Singapore, as well as Poland, been pretty big buyers of gold over the last 2 years.
Do you think that the gold miners need to catch up? And do you think they'll catch up to the degree where it'll match the rise that we've seen in gold? Or do you think the central bank forces are so strong that it makes the physical asset more advantageous?
Yeah, well, we often will tell our clients that, you know, you have to think about gold and gold miners in two different buckets. Gold has a very unique set of attributes that it brings a portfolio. And clearly, it's acting as a financial asset for these central banks around the world. Gold miners obviously provide a lot of operating leverage and optionality to a higher gold price. And historically, in bull markets, they have outperformed. Now, the last couple of years, I would say they've lagged. And that's just really because there's been a very strong underpinning of gold buying support by central banks. And we haven't seen that same kind of support from institutional and retail investors for gold stocks. Part of that was because I think profit margins were under pressure as inflation had eroded some of their profitability. But we definitely, in the last 6 weeks or so, have seen gold stocks, I think, perform much better. And I think that's a very healthy sign that there's some appetite returning.
Hey, John, it's Tim. Thanks for joining us. I guess the institutional part of this move, I think, also is something that's really should be emphasized, because look, spot price in gold is ultimately what analysts do and create a lot of their models for. And we've started to see almost mechanically you have to see upgrades even for miners based upon this. But get back to, again, the core investors that you know, been following Sprott forever and investing in your funds. Seems to me this gold move is so underrepresented by institutions. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, you raise a really good point. I would say that overall, if you take a look at how gold is positioned right now across portfolios, it's at a very low amount, a very low percentage. And it doesn't take a lot of rebalancing from different asset classes into gold to really move the price. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with central banks. They seem to be, as our market strategist Paul Wong recently wrote, totally price insensitive to the gold price. They just keep buying when it's available. When you think about institutional investors, the best barometer for their interest and demand for gold is in the ETFs. And we track those every day. And they've been in net redemption globally for the last year or so, which tells us that institutional investors are really not interested in gold. Now, that's starting to change a little bit. We've seen some green shoots. Even our physical gold trust today, we raised over $35 million of new capital. So we'll be buying gold on Monday. So we are starting to see some green shoots, but I would say it's really been Eastern investors, including Chinese retail investors, that have really been underpinning the demand. And Western investors have largely ignored this rally, which we think over time, especially if we start to see some heightened geopolitical risks, we're going to see a shift back to the safe haven.
So do you think that that's just the geopolitical risk that'll sort of catalyze Western investors, institutional investors, that is, to buy gold? And what is, I mean, historically, is there an allocation that we should think about in terms of the gold market? Western institutional investors typically are allocated this much to gold, and right now they are at this level?
Yeah, so if you look at those numbers right now, we think it's somewhere in the sub 2% range in terms of their overall allocation. At the height of the last bull market, it was somewhere close to 8%. So we're way off of those cyclical highs. And as I said, it doesn't take a lot of capital to start moving around buckets. And I think the safe haven element of gold, if we have, you know, an escalation of Middle East tensions or whatever, that's clearly going to be, I think, one of the catalysts that will bring more Western money back into gold.
John, thanks for your time. Great to speak with you. John
Centralia
of Sprott. You had an interesting chart today, Carter, that you blasted to clients and us folks.
Yeah, I was just looking at gold versus S&P. They're in a dead heat 27 years later. I mean, that's most people's entire career, to think all of the efforts to buy and sell the market, and yet gold, which is sort of a little bit ridiculed, has kept up with the S&P for 27 years. A couple things also. If you added up the entire market cap of all stocks in the Philadelphia Gold and Silver Index, it's like $270 billion. That's what Netflix market cap is. It's a very small area of the market. So just as John was saying, the leverage that can kick in from operating businesses at some point, and you'll note that over the past month, GDX is up 12%, GLD is up 8%, meaning you're starting to get that leverage.
Yeah. Tim, just quickly, you've been sort of pounding the table on gold for some time, both the miners and the physical. But thinking about a 2% allocation going to a historic 8%, I mean, that's
massive,
that's,
and I think that's important. By the way, I'm long Sprott as a stock, so I'm long their company. I'm long A-Mark, which is a gold dealer. I think there's other ways to play this. But and back to the China, China's gold reserves as a percentage of overall reserves are the lowest of any central bank in Asia. They're probably around 6%. The average is around 20%. They have the third largest reserves in the world. I mean, they have a lot of work to do here, but the institutional underinvestment, I think, is fascinating.
Coming up, Netflix, Taiwan Semi, United Airlines, and plenty of other big names reporting earnings next week. We'll take a deep dive into the options market to find out how traders are gearing up to play those results next. Plus, commodity prices putting the squeeze on Starbucks and its customers. We'll debate whether the coffee chain can brew up a turnaround ahead. And because of the sudden market volatility, we will have a live market update Sunday night. Starts at 6 p.m. on CNBC.com. We'll get you set up for the week ahead amid serious new concerns for investors. That is Sunday, 6 p.m. live on CNBC.com. Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Earnings season heats up next week with Goldman Sachs, United Health, Procter & Gamble, and Taiwan Semi among the names reporting Q1 results. We wanted to home in on two names in particular, United Airlines and Netflix. Carter's got the charts, and Mike Coe will join us with a trade, an options trade. So let's kick it off with Netflix. Reports Thursday after the close. So, Carter, what do you see in the charts?
Well, we used to call this Coe and Carter, so let's get right to it. chart. So let's look at Netflix first. And what we know is, this is a stock that, unlike so many, has yet to recoup all of its losses of the bear market of 2022. So the presumption is that it will make it back to the high. So I'm playing on the long side, going into earnings.
Mike, the trade on Netflix?
Yeah, this thing outperformed today. I mean, obviously it was down a little bit, but it outperformed the sector, and I think looks pretty good here. It's obviously trading at a decent multiple, too, about 36 times earnings, and growing about as fast. So I think what we want to use is a calendar here. I was looking at the April-July 650 call calendar. That's going to cost about $26. Take advantage of the elevated premium in the options market, implying about 8% move next week after they report.
Let's move on to United Airlines. That reports Tuesday after the bell. Shares are struggling to take off this year amid a string of safety incidents. So, Carter, what's the next move from here?
You just covered it, struggling to take off. So let's look at the chart. It's sideways. Is this what a pair of twos is? It's not, I would say, worth doing. But the short-term chart, the longer-term chart still has risk. This, in airlines in general, I mean, if you look at the New York Stock Exchange ARCA Airline Index, it's unchanged for 25 years. Mm,
that's interesting. Mike, what's the trade on that?
Yeah, I'd rather own Delta in any case if I was going to own the airlines. Actually, we do own Delta, but we don't own United Air. This one also expecting a move of about 8%. That's well above the average. And again, I want to take advantage of the elevated premium that we see as a result. I was looking at a put calendar this time, the April 39, July 39 calendar. That was going to cost about $1.50. And I think that's a way to play either a sideways move or a move to that strike price, which is down about 6-7% from here.
Which do you like, Bonawin?
I like the call calendar. I typically like when Mike kind of, you know, takes advantage of a spike in short-term volatility and then has the opportunity to roll if you get a move in the stock or you see another spike from unprecedented geopolitical risk.
Tim, on actually your pick because you have both, right?
Yeah, I don't. I sold Netflix a little too soon. Oh. I would be long on the long side. But United, I think you're going to see downgrades here based upon higher fuel price and lower anticipated capacity. I continue to think airlines are trading stocks, and I think history shows that. Even though Delta has been a long term long for me, and I stay long.
You got to go with airlines that have zero exposure to the 737 MAX. Delta has zero exposure to that to them. United has exposure. American has exposure. So that's the way I would gauge it when you're dealing with the airlines. Netflix, the chart actually looks like it's rolling over for the first time in a very long time. And it always surprises you with that spike higher. Mm-hmm. But I think the tailwinds at a certain point, everyone, even the bulls would agree on Netflix that at a certain point, it's got to take another rest.
Does the Delta chart look better than United?
Oh, much.
Okay.
Much better. Yeah. Not even close.
Much so pair of two.
Pair of jacks?
What? Yeah. How about a pair of jacks? There we go. Pair of jacks.
Pair of jacks.
Pair of jacks.
Pair of jacks.
I don't know what that means, but that's better, apparently. Coming up, feeling the grind. Starbucks getting roasted as coffee prices soar to new 52-week highs. Should you ditch the dark roast, or is there more to this pour-over play? We'll debate that. Huh. Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. Starbucks continuing its slide today, dropping about 1%. The stock's now down 7% just this month and more than 11% this year. The plunge comes as coffee prices surge, settling up nearly 1.5% today, their highest since September 2022. Other coffee stocks like J.M. Smucker, which owns Dunkin' and Folgers, and Keurig Dr. Pepper slipping today as well. Starbucks may have other problems than just the high price of coffee beans at this point. So where do we stand on Starbucks?
Yeah, so the way I look at it is I go back on coffee chart and I go back where coffee was higher than where it is now. And then I look at where Starbucks was at that point. So there's always that lead and a lag with the stock price versus the underlying commodity. And as you said before, Starbucks has a host of other issues that might be causing the decline in price. But when you look at just strictly where coffee was when it was higher, Starbucks price was around $71, $72.
Deutsche Bank had a survey on the issue of price, not the stock, but of the coffee itself. And they said among 45% of customers buying less or no longer buying, price was the number one reason. It is getting too expensive. People are sick and tired of paying $7 or whatever for a latte, whatever expensive drink you're getting. And that's finally catching up.
Look, I'll never buy a latte, but a good old-fashioned coffee is something that costs $4.30. That same coffee cost probably $2.80 probably pre-COVID. I mean, it's absurd, I think, what they've done. I think there's an expectation by the investor community that you're going to see an EPS guidance. You're going to see a cut. And that there's a combination of things. You've got higher input costs. That also includes labor. Remember, they've had some very significant labor dynamics within Starbucks. They've had the unionization, at least concerns, and certainly higher prices. But I think you're going to see lower margins and a company that I love Starbucks, the stock. I love the product. I go there all the time. I'm frustrated. But I think you're going to buy it lower. And I'm not buying it here.
But seasonally, the spring and summer are better times because they're more dependent on cold drinks, which have better margins. And then people want cold drinks starting now. So that could be an offset.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's trading around a 52-week low. You mentioned the seasonality of it. And also, if you kind of look back at the price to earnings, it's trading pretty much at a historical low over the last 10 years. So probably an opportunity.
Up next, final trades. Time for the final trade. Tim.
Total Energies, the Exxon of France, and that chart is out of control. I think their cost base is better than Exxon's.
Bono in.
DXY, I think there's room to run with the dollar, and I think, you know, the dispersion that we're seeing amongst central banks probably persists.
Carter Braxton Worth.
Buy bonds. TLT will get you done.
Steve.
I think it was a fun show, given that we had a terrible day in the markets. CCK, Crown Holdings. CCK.
That's fine. Thanks for watching Fast Money. Have a great weekend. See you back here on Monday. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now. It was amazing.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Fast Money Disclaimer.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.